MyMac.com Podcast 109.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com Podcast.
Hey, what's up? Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com Podcast. This is our 109th podcast, 109th weekly podcast. Sounds a little bit more impressive, as you know, if it was just a daily podcast, 109 wouldn't be that big of a deal, but this is a weekly podcast, and 109 of them is a pretty big deal for us. We're coming up on Macworld Expo in just a few weeks now. I've got my plane ticket, I've got my hotel reservation, and it looks like I might have picked a bad hotel to stay at. I'll find out when I get there. Hope it doesn't suck, and if it does, well, we'll see if I can stay at somewhere else. This week we're going to talk to, Guy Searle, Chad Perry, and myself did an interview with Paul Kent. You won't be able to tell from the interview, really, but about halfway through the interview, it died. We lost our connection at Chad's house. That's where we recorded the interview. And his internet connection just went, and it was gone, and we couldn't save it, couldn't get it back. And consequently, we lost, the end of our podcast interview. So when you hear the interview end, that actually wasn't the end of the interview, and it wasn't the last of the questions that we were going to ask Paul. But, you know, sometimes technology doesn't agree with you, and sometimes things crash, and you lose everything. Speaking of crashing, this is actually the second time I've recorded the intro to this podcast. The first one, I was about 10 minutes into it. It was absolutely brilliant, of course. It was award-winning segments. It was awesome. You'd have loved it. It was great. But kernel panic on my Mac and lost everything, which sucked big time. And it sucked even more for my wife, because she wants to get to the TiVo and watch the season finale of The Amazing Race. And, of course, I've got to record this instead. So she's chomping at the bit in the other room going, hurry up with a stupid podcast so I can catch The Amazing Race. Anyways, our sponsor for this podcast, as it has been for a long time, is Small Dog Electronics. Check them out at smalldog.com. If you're looking for a new iPod, and you've already got an older iPod, but, you know, maybe it just doesn't hold all of your tunes. That was my problem for a long time until I got the 80 gig version. I had a 30 gig fourth generation that, you know, it held about half of my music, and I always hated having to decide what I was going to put on there and what I wasn't going to put on there. It seemed like such a chore. Well, one of the things that you can do with Small Dog Electronics is trade in your old iPod for some cashola towards the new iPod. Let's say you've got, I don't know, a 20 gig iPod photo. That's worth $60. So that's $60 off a new iPod if you trade it in. If you've got, say, a 60 gig iPod photo, that's $115 off. The best deal, though, if you've got a fifth generation 60 gig hard drive iPod, 60 gigabyte iPod, fifth generation, $135. So that's pretty cool. In fact, that's really cool. Fortunately, I don't need an iPod right now. I do have an 80 gig fifth generation. It's the first fifth generation. I wish they would have called the 5.5 generation the sixth generation. It's annoying that they didn't, but I'm happy with my iPod. I don't plan on getting anything new for a while. Although if Apple does come out with that, you know, the real video iPod, or the iPod phone, or the iPhone, which is all the talk the last couple weeks, it might be time for me to pick up a new iPod. And if I do, I'm probably going to trade in. I've got a fourth generation iPod that my wife uses. I'll give her the fifth generation, and I'll get an iPod phone, providing it can hold all my music, which it probably can't. It's probably going to be, like, you know, 2 to 4 gigabyte, like a Nano, and I'll still get the iPhone, but I won't replace my iPod with it. Anyways, though, check out smalldog.com for their iPod trade-in program. It's pretty cool. You can save some cash, and what else are you going to do with that old iPod? Unless you've got another family member who can use it, it's just going to be sitting there not doing anything. So, might as well trade it in, save yourself some cash on a new iPod. And that's from smalldog.com. This week's show, we've got, like I said, the interview with Paul Kent from IDG. He's the guy who pretty much runs the Macworld Expo. So if you want to know what goes into planning and executing an expo, well, not executing as in killing, but, you know, executing as in, you know, running the show, you might be interested in this interview. We appreciate Paul coming on the show. I wish we didn't have the technical difficulties that towards the end of his interview, but like I said, things happen. John Nemirovsky's Book Bites Live. It's the audio portion of his Book Bites columns that he's been writing for, geez, almost 8 years now. He did an interview this week with Andy Anacco, which he's one of my favorite Mac authors. I think you guys are going to enjoy that. I did. And unfortunately, he recorded it incorrectly, Andy's portion of the interview. This is still pretty new, doing interviews over the internet with John, and for a lot of people, a lot of you guys. And like anybody else, there's a learning curve, and John figured out what he should not have done. And he's got that corrected for the upcoming interviews after Andy's. But for this one, I'm going to have to really get in there and edit it some, so you guys can... I got to boost up Andy's side of the conversation. And maybe John will do a special Book Bites Live where he can explain how he does interviews, the settings that he uses. I think that might be pretty interesting. Or at the very least, maybe he can do an article online. I think maybe a text article would probably work better. That way he can get into depth how he's doing all these great interviews. But the Andy Anacco interview is really entertaining. He's a really good writer. And hats off to John for getting an interview with Andy. Robert Hazelrug. Yeah, I know. I always say his name wrong. It's on purpose. He does a review of Picture at Postage, which is kind of neat. Something that I might look into myself. And the game Wingnuts, which is kind of funny because that's a game that Guy Searle actually did a first look at, jeez, like 2 years ago. And it's just now coming out. But it'd be a great game after that long in development. David Cohen, our London Bureau Chief, talks about desktop management on the Mac and the PC on his Fenestration segment. And that's coming up right after the interview with Paul Kent and IDG. And, of course, Not Mac News with Guy Searle. We've got a couple more of Guy Searle's Not Mac News on the current format, but we're going to change that up. We're going to kind of go with a Daily Show type of... well, you know what? I'm gonna let that breathe. We've got a really cool idea of how we're going to do the Not Mac News segments, and I think it's going to work really, really good. It's not going to be Guy doing them by himself anymore. It ought to be fun. If you watch The Daily Show and how they do, like, reporters in the field, mock reporters in the mock field, I guess you'd say. We're kind of going to go with that format with Not Mac News coming up in the next couple of episodes or so. And I'm really looking forward to doing it. I'm going to play the straight-laced, in the studio, asking Guy the questions that he's going to completely make up the answers to. And, of course, that's what Not Mac News is all about. Completely fake news. So again, thanks to smalldog.com for downloading or for sponsoring this podcast, and thank you for downloading the podcast. And on with the show. It's 1 month away, the beginning of Macworld Expo 2007, and I can hardly wait. I'm going to be there. Guy's going to be there. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like Chad's going to be there, correct?
No.
Unfortunately, we're going to miss you, Chad. But we got Paul Kent on the line.
He's a guy from who's always there.
Yeah, Paul's always there. Hi, Paul.
I'm always there 24/7, all week long.
All year long, pretty much. This is pretty much a you have to plan this Macworld Expo the entire year. I mean, this isn't like any downtime for you guys at all, is it?
You know, we actually start planning a little bit before the previous Macworld. So actually, we're starting to have some conversations about things we want to have at the show this year that we want to tell people about next year. So, like, a lot of the exhibitors sign up at the show for the following show. We need some things to tell them, so we actually do some preparation for 2008, 13 months in advance. And pretty much the day we get back, pretty much the day we get back from a Macworld, we're pointed towards the next one, and we just work on it year round, always trying to make it better, always trying to make it more interesting, fix the things that maybe weren't perfect. Listen to all the advice that people give us and try and put together the things that make sense.
Well, you know, I personally think you guys should change the name. It shouldn't be Macworld Expo. It should be My Mac Expo. I think that would work so much yeah. better.
That's pretty
not
catchy.
That we're prejudiced or anything.
You got a logo?
Yeah, actually, yeah.
Yeah, we do.
We got a new one that's in the works, actually. How do you possibly keep track of all the vendors, all the press, all the product announcements? How do you stay on top of that? Do you have like 1,000 people that work for IDG that works on the expo itself?
It's a team of about 10 to 12 people that work on Macworld. A little bit of the year they might be working on something else that we put on, but 10 to 12 people pretty constantly are shepherding Macworld Expo. It's a great team. I mean, we have wonderful exhibitor sales reps who take good care of all the exhibitors, all the new ones who call in to find out if the show's for them. We have an amazing marketing team who gets the word out, great PR people who deal with the press. So I've got great help. And these are all, you know, raving MacHeads who work on the show. They all believe in the show. They all just want to do the best and as much as possible turn a 40,000-person event to feeling like someone's home away from home for a week.
Now, let me ask you, the last time we talked to you was a year ago, almost exactly. Mm-hmm. You're in a different position with IDG now, correct?
Yeah, actually, when we spoke last, I was the conference chair, which I had been for actually the previous 10 years, organizing just the conferences. But starting the first of the year, January 1st, I actually took over as the general manager for the whole show. And so everything that happens at Macworld kind of falls under my umbrella.
So we know who to blame then.
So what are you looking forward to the most? Obviously, this is a business venture for you, but as a MacHead yourself, what's the boost that you really look forward to each and every year?
Well, you know, the biggest thing, again, is creating an environment that 40,000 people, and yet it feels familiar, that they can find their friends and their colleagues that they haven't seen for a year. Right. So making this event feel unsterile and really a Mac event that's ideal for the Mac industry, that's the thing that kind of drives us all along. You know, how the signage looks, how you get from one place to another, what the flow of information is, all those little types of things that really form an experience, that's what we're into.
Now, you guys are starting some new conferences this year during the expo as well, correct?
Yeah, we've got a lot of new things going on in the conference area. So, you know, we have 5 days of education. There's all different types of packages that people can get involved with to pick and choose the days that they want. We have our 2-day classes called Power Tools, which are 2 days pretty much on a single software product. If you really want to perfect your expertise in a particular software product, the Power Tools are for you. We also have 2 conference programs. We have our Mac IT program, which is for the really hardcore enterprise IT managers, a lot of networking and communication stuff, and that's a very successful event where we are kind of hosting about 500 to 750 enterprise managers. We also have our Mac Users Conference, where we help people improve their Mac skills, their creative skills, their small business skills. And then our newest things are called Market Symposiums. We started them last year, where instead of like a software product like we do with the Power Tools, it's 1 day all about a particular market segment. So we have one for small business people. We have one for art directors. We have one for new media artists. We have a ripping one on for K-12 educators. So if there are any educators out there that really want to take a look at how the Mac is enhancing the K-12 environment, a K-12 market symposium would be for you. And, you know, all these things, if you take 5 days education, pretty much you've got a sore head at the end of the week, but it's a lot of fun.
Hmm. So what's it like working with the educational segment of the market?
That's fabulous. I mean, you know, educators are such appreciative Mac customers. They give us a lot of feedback. They love the show. They love their Macs. They love teaching with their Macs. It's really one of the most outwardly enthusiastic crowds that we talk to.
If I can ask something real quick here, say I'm a Windows user that's thinking about going to the Mac. Well, what's at the Expo for someone like me?
Well, I think the first thing that happens when you walk through the Expo doors into Macworld, if you're a Windows user, you're really charged by the excitement that people still have for a computing platform. I mean, you go to a Windows conference or kind of a PC generic thing, and it's, you know, it's kind of something you have to do. It's something, you know, that it's a tool that sits on your desk, and they really have kind of gotten over the whole excitement about computing. You walk into Macworld, and there's just a buzz. I mean, there's just an intensity. And then you go through, and you see the new products, and you see the enthusiasm. You actually get inspired to sit in front of your computer again. So that would be the first thing. And the other thing for PC users is all the world's a buzz right now about how the Windows world and the Macworld are on a collision course. Everything from Apple's Boot Camp, the software that's in beta from the Leopard release that's coming, all the way through the amazing things that they're doing with that Parallels computing environment.
Oh, right.
I mean, it's fabulous stuff, and it's going to be an extremely interesting year. So if there are Windows users who are curious about the Mac and want to learn how they can slowly transition over or quickly transition over, lots of information. We've got conference classes that welcome you. We've even got Bob Levitas, Dr. McIntosh. He's teaching an introduction to Mac class, especially for people coming over from the Windows platform. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah. We'd love to have them. Those are the converts that we love coming to the show.
Now you've got the show that's out there on the West Coast, and there hasn't been an East Coast Macworld in a couple of years. Any chance that Macworld could return to the East Coast?
You know, right now, I'd have to say it's not likely. There may be other smaller things that we put on the East Coast. So we do another event called the Mac Networkers Retreat that's been in Monterey, California. Right. And there's been a lot of requests for that to come to the East Coast as well. But, you know, Macworld, the beginning of January, a big show. It really seems to satisfy quite a bit of the universe. I mean, you know that a lot of trade shows, you know, haven't been doing so well. Macworld's been thriving. Macworld San Francisco is this awesome event that keeps growing and growing and growing. People seem to get that, and San Francisco is such a fabulous city to hold a conference in. So I think you're going to see the big show, Macworld Expo, stay in San Francisco for quite a while.
Now, unfortunately, CES is taking place at the same time as Macworld, and one of our writers will be covering CES, and most of us is going to be at Macworld. Was there any concern on your part about CES happening at the same time as the Macworld Expo?
Absolutely none at all. We say bring it on. You know, we've been in our dates and our time slot for many, many years. It's really two different audiences. CES is more for kind of a trade event where resellers of electronics products, not a lot of end users go there, whereas Macworld is this, you know, glorious kind of Woodstock of
celebration of all things Mac.
Yeah, well, and actually it's becoming more things technical, right? So what happens at Macworld is you get fine artists, you get musicians, you get videographers, you get photographers, you get all these amazing creative disciplines coming to one place at one time to hang out, to learn from each other, to go to classes together. And so the vibe is much different, the focus is much different, the purpose is much different. So, you know, we're not expecting to see any change to our growth patterns at all as a result of CES being the same weeks.
Now, it's obviously called Macworld, but and it's not called Apple World, probably for a reason, because it's not just about Apple, it's about the entire Mac universe. Mm-hmm. But the Mac universe over the last 5 years has expanded greatly. It could almost be called, a couple of years ago, the iPod Expo. Has any thought been given to an iPod-centric type of expo?
No, we don't think that there's really a purpose for that. I mean, our stuff is about showing a computing platform, hardware and software. You know, the iPod is a wonderful device in so much as that it connects to a Macintosh, but we've got plenty of stuff to do to show the world how Macs interact with each other, with other platforms, how creative tools can work to their best ability. So it really is Macworld Expo. We're about Mac hardware, OS X products and services, software and hardware. So it is Macworld Expo.
So are you guys ever in a position where you have to turn down any potential vendors that want to show up, have a booth at the expo?
Like, say, Greenpeace?
I don't know that they have a product that they would show up with.
I got to imagine there's times that there's vendors that probably doesn't fit the demographic of the audience.
I wasn't kidding about that. I mean, we're about buyers and sellers of Mac products. That's what the show is about.
Yeah.
And you know, that's who we're putting together. It's not anything other than the world's greatest showplace for Macintosh products.
My question is, have you ever had to kick a vendor out? I've seen it, not in a Macworld Expo, but other venues that I've been to, that I've seen actual people on the showroom floor get kicked out. Because they were bugging other vendors and stuff. Has that ever happened to you? I'm not asking for specifics. We don't want to single anybody out. But have you ever had to ask a vendor to leave because they were acting inappropriate?
So me personally, remember, I was on the conference side for 10 years. And, you know, we've never had to kick anyone out of the conference. But, you know, that's just the kind of the fringe part of what goes on at expos is, you know, sometimes people get charged up or whatever. It's really such a small part of the things that go on. Many years, nothing goes on. and other years things go on and nobody even notices because it gets taken care of so efficiently.
Now, what's more popular in your... Obviously, I don't expect you to release any numbers, but is the conferences more popular than the showroom floor during the expo, or does the showroom floor see more traffic?
Well, both are very popular, and both have kind of the capacities that they can host. Basically, at the end of the day, it's 40,000 people coming to San Francisco. We train in our conferences over 5,000 people, making Macworld one of the largest educational technical events in the country. And with about 35,000 people who come just to the expo only, it certainly is one of the biggest events in San Francisco and certainly still one of the biggest technology events in the world.
Now, I got to ask you a question. We talked about how much prep goes into this. When do you guys stop? I mean, Macworld Expo is almost like Sunday at church. So when does the pastor take a day off?
Nope. Don't think we do. I mean, it's really... And the thing is, since the marketplace has been growing again, ever since Steve Jobs came back and all these amazing products, doesn't feel like work. I got to tell you, it's really a joy. I mean, it's almost like opening up our house to 40,000 of our closest friends. They come in, you know, we have a good time. It's people who love cool technology. There's a common bond between the people who come to Macworld. And so, I don't know, this is about as good a job as you could ask for.
We want to thank Paul Kent for coming on to the show today and talking about the Macworld Expo. The Expo and Conference goes on from January 8th through the 12th for the conferences, and the Expo takes place the 9th through the 12th, of course. That's January 2007, and as we have for over the last decade, MyMac.com will be there reporting live from the show.
Yep.
We're going to have pictures.
Yep. Video.
We're going to have podcasting.
Yep.
We're going to have a lot of cool stuff.
Yep, and we're going to make a special effort to try to get to some of the booths that you may not normally have a chance to get to, even if you're at the expo.
And we're going to try our darndest to get some really fun people in front of the camera and behind the microphone. So make sure during the expo week that you bookmark and come back to MyMac.com daily and often.
Hello, my name is David Cohen and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, my guide to using a Mac in a Windows world. On this Fenestration segment, I'm going to talk a little bit about desktop management. One of the issues that you face as a user if you're using Windows and a Mac operating system on the same computer is managing your desktops between the two. Obviously, in the Windows environment, you want to keep that environment maximized as much as possible. Windows doesn't make particularly good use of screen space, in my opinion, and the applications within Windows normally expect to be fully maximized when you're using them, unless you have a particular need to see more than one window at once. This is why Windows applications all come with a maximize button that's part of the operating system that's up in the top corner of the window. Now, Mac applications don't really expect to work in the same way. The application icons that you get for the window in the Mac operating system under OS X will actually allow you to resize the window so it's big enough to fit whatever you're actually doing at one time. Consequently, it's actually quite difficult under OS X to actually maximize applications so they fill the entire window. And this causes a problem for you if you're using Windows within a window, either under Parallels on an Intel Mac or using Virtual PC. You've got a conflict. You really want your Windows applications to be as large as possible, and you really want your Windows environment to be as large as possible. But OS X is not really designed to allow you to do that particularly easily. This can lead to a situation where you spend a lot of time resizing Windows, which might be in a Windows application, and you're actually trying to resize the Windows environment itself so that it's visible to maximum degree within your OS X desktop. Now, one solution around this is to go full screen when you're using the Windows side. But of course, the disadvantage of that is you can't see anything of OS X at the same time. The other problem you may find is that when you maximize your virtual PC or Parallels environment to be full screen, of course, you lose access to a lot of the OS X stuff that's running behind. And you actually have to hit a couple of keystrokes to actually bring up any OS X features. So if you want to change volume or access your function keys or maybe eject your CD drive from the OS X side, you have to actually physically come out of the Windows environment by breaking the full screen and shrinking it back down to a window. This rapidly becomes inconvenient in your workflow. One solution that I found that users may want to consider is to use virtual desktops as a way of getting around this. Now, virtual desktops is a concept that's been around for quite a while. The idea is that rather than have one desktop which you run your applications in, you have more than one, and you can switch between them in much the same way that you'd switch between applications. Apple has said that in the next version of OS X, 10.5 Leopard, they will be including this feature, calling it Spaces. And it will work much as I describe. You'll have multiple application desktops. Each of them will have their own dock, their own set of application icons if you wish, and you'll be able to move between them using Expose in much the same way that you move between application windows at the moment. Now, this is a good solution for people running Windows environments within a window, because it means you can keep your Windows environment maximized on one screen and then very quickly switch to another desktop where you've got your OS X environment. Now, as I said, this feature will be built into OS X Leopard, but you don't have to wait that long. There are a couple of third-party applications that allow you to do this with your current 10.4 or 10.3 OS X setup. The best one that I've found is one called Virtue Desktops. It's the best one I've found because it's free. It can be downloaded from www.virtuedesktops.info. As always, I'll put a link into the show notes covering that link, so you can click straight to it. Now, Virtue Desktops is an open source project, which is what makes it free, and it really is a nice bit of software. You'll see from the website that it is continually being developed with new features being added in, so this particular developer has not been shaken by the fact that Apple is planning to put this feature into the next version of OS X and is continuing to develop the application. It installs nice and simply, and you get a little menu up on the right side of the screen that shows all the desktops that you actually set up. On my particular system, I've got three. I've got a main desktop which I use for general applications. I've got one called Parallels, which I use for my Windows environment. And then I've got one called Browsing, where I put all my news reading and my web browsing, so that that's separate from anything else that I happen to be doing. The application's very flexible. There are various different ways you can change how you switch between applications and how you switch between desktops. And also you can bind particular applications so that when you run them, they always run on the same desktop. It's very well documented. And what I really like about it is that there are various different ways of switching between the desktops. I happen to use Control and Shift and the arrow keys. And these key bindings work even if you've got a full screen Windows environment going. So what I do is I fire up Parallels and I load up Windows and then I send that full screen, and that takes up one entire desktop. But that's purely Windows. So anybody looking at my computer while I'm on that desktop would assume that I'm actually in boot camp and running Windows full screen. However, if I hit Control Shift and up, then I switch from that to my browsing environment where I have my web browser open and also my newsreader. And then if I press Control Shift up again, it cycles up to my main one, where I tend to keep Finder windows and any other applications that I might be running in OS X at the same time. If I press Control Shift up again, then it cycles back to the Parallels environment, full screen windows. So it's a very neat way of moving between Windows and OS X environments, while at the same time maximizing the screen space that you've got to actually work in those environments. Now, this application should work just the same with Virtual PC on the Mac PowerPC side. Now, there are similar programs available that do the same sort of thing. There's one called Desktop Manager, and there's another one from a company called Codetech called Virtual Desktop. Desktop Manager is another open source application, whereas Codetech Virtual Desktop is chargeable. So there are several options available to you should you find the Virtue Desktops application not work well for you for any particular reason. That's going to do it for this session. As always, questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time.
Here on Book Bites Live, the topic for today is If You've Got It, You Can iPod It. The author is Andy Inatko. The title is iPod Fully Loaded. Publisher is Wiley Publisher. Price is $20 US, 24 Canadian, 14 pounds UK, and the page count is 276. Welcome, Andy Inatko, one of our favorite writers and one of the most notable Mac notables, to Book Bites Live on the MyMac.com podcast. And Andy is our guest. How do you pronounce your last name, Andy?
Inatko.
Just exactly how it reads.
Well, the way that people usually remember it is, I do not know how to pronounce this guy's name.
Gotcha. Well, your book is completely cross-platform, iPod fully loaded. How easy or difficult was it to go through all those different steps in both Windows and Mac versions of the iPod, and then on both different types of computer platforms?
Well, the tough part was making sure that it was all consistent, and also making sure that something that I thought was really, really cool, that really, really worked well on one platform, I could find another solution totally separately on the other side. A lot of what started off this book was the fact that I use Automator and AppleScript and all kinds of other tools to do kind of unexpected things with my iPod, basically to turn it into a PDA, sometimes even turn it into a laptop. And sometimes, so I write out the outline, I think I know what I can do and other things, but then comes like the 2 weeks I have to spend thinking, okay, look, is there a way you can do this on the Windows without having access to Automator? But of course, the benefit of having Windows is that you don't have something like Automator, but you do have millions more programmers who are trying to develop software. So time and time again, this is another one of the benefits of being a Mac owner. So many things that on the Mac side come out to, well, here's an Automator workflow that'll do this for you automatically, and then I go to the Windows side of it and say, okay, download and then pay for this $30 program.
Yeah.
But either way, it works out great.
Good. Well, interestingly enough, you leave us guessing as to your personal conversion format and bitrate for the audio tracks that you use. Can you explain what settings you, Andy, use for ripping songs from CDs?
I wouldn't say I'm so much mysterious, so much as trying to convey the fact that you shouldn't just go by the defaults that Apple assigns you with iTunes, and also the settings that you're going to choose will depend on what your priorities are. My priorities are, gosh, I want archive. I want this to be like the Library of Congress version of my They Might Be Giants album. So I rip at a very high bit rate, at least 256K. I generally speaking rip into MP3 format, just so that if I want to put it on my cell phone or put it onto a Windows machine, I never have to worry about whether or not the player that I want to use will support AAC or not. Because obviously, you know, the iPod is the fulcrum of all my audio, but then again, you never know if you're ripping 700 CDs, which is what I did last year.
Yeah.
You don't want to have to re-rip it a second or a third time.
No kidding.
Yes, and I tend to turn off variable bitrate encoding exactly for that same reason, because occasionally I found that there is some hardware that just doesn't like variable bitrate. But for most people, the default settings will work just fine. I mean, when Apple tells you you'll get 10,000 songs in this iPod, they're telling you to use these conservative settings. But goodness, I mean, right now, if you remember how easy it was to get your, how cheap it was to put an AOL CD on everything you buy,
yeah,
disk storage space and memory storage space is falling just the same way. And now it was a bigger issue when people had a 512 megabyte shuffle, but now everybody has at least 2 gigs on their thing. So I always think that it's better to have the higher quality recording in there.
Good answer. Why would you say QuickTime Pro is an important, worthwhile asset for just about every iPod or Mac or Windows?
Because it's Occam's razor. It's the most simple solution to taking any piece of video and nearly any piece of audio in any format you have and making sure you can convert it to a format that your iPod is going to like. There are a bunch of utilities. Some of them are free. Some of them cost money. That are more ambitious. They are just that these tools are designed to take any file format you have and convert it to any other video format you have. For instance, on the PC side, there's a really nice piece of software called a Total Video Converter that I use, as a matter of fact, to convert my QuickTimes into videos I can watch on any cell phone. But QuickTime is written by Apple. It's supported by Apple, which means that there is never any question that their video to iPod converter or their audio to iPod converter will work exactly the way that iTunes expects it to. And it does support, you know, it's not the cheapest utility per feature out there, but for $30, it will convert again to iPod formats. It'll convert to generic formats. It'll even convert to cell phone formats. So yeah. Again, if you did buy this really cool, you know, pocket sized like Razer phone, and you want to get this 3G style video format, I just the other day I was converting an episode of MythBusters to my memory card for my little cell phone. Mm-hmm. Not because I watch TV on my cell phone, but because I like to be able to have something to take out of my pocket to demonstrate that I'm at least one of the top three geeks in any room.
What is the bonus appendix material on the Wiley website you mentioned as a teaser?
Well, I wanted to try to give as much value for the money. So a lot of the stuff that's going to land on the website are things like, again, all those automator actions, all those scripts that I mentioned in the book. Obviously, the days of being able to, you know, staple a CD in with every book are both long and gone and be completely unnecessary. Every time that I show you an automator workflow in the book, it's a simple one-page screenshot. You just simply, you know, make your own automator window look like my automator window, and
so okay,
you will be able to print your email right to your iPod as voice files. But for people who are not, excuse me, pardon me, for people who aren't quite that savvy, they're uploaded, and they will run as standalone plugins.
Very good. Two important questions about you and about the book. Well, is there a website where listeners and readers of MyMac.com podcast can learn more about Andy?
Yeah, well, of course, I have one of these webtastical sites, as you've read about in Time and Newsweek. If you head out to CWOB.com, that stands for Colossal Waste of Bandwidth, you'll be able to find my website. Most importantly, you'll be able to find my blog. That has just things I'm thinking of, places you can read me, that sort of stuff. And hopefully I'm going to be putting more stuff, updating the book as we go along. I was actually very, very pleased. It looks like I got a little bit ahead of myself on the book. I was expecting that in 3 months' time, there would be all kinds of new utilities and all kinds of new techniques and, of course, all kinds of new iPods out there. But this thing was designed to begin with to work with any iPod you have. It'll even work with the iPod Shuffle. If you want to experience DVDs on your iPod Shuffle, this book will tell you how to do that. So even if you have a first-generation 5-year-old iPod, it'll work just fine. But these techniques will work with things that you bought last week and things you bought 2 years ago.
Good. Well, I want to remind our readers and listeners that we're talking to Andy, who's the author of iPod Fully Loaded. If you've got it, you can pod it. It's from Wiley Publishers. The price is $20 U.S., 24 Canadian, 14 pounds U.K.
Violent discounts on Amazon. Violent discounts. You must be arrested for what we're selling this for.
And the last question is, who are the optimum purchasers of iPod Fully Loaded?
You know, it sounds cheeky when you say that you want everybody to buy it, but I really do want everybody to buy this, because people who just bought their very first iPod out of the box, they will learn techniques for optimizing their simple CD ripping. I'm sure that the second thing they want to think about is, hey, I've got all kinds of old tapes and old LPs I want to convert. Well, this will tell you in great detail how to do that. But even those folks who have had their iPods for about a year or two, they may not know, well, how do I take a Microsoft Word file and be able to use it on my iPod? How do I use my iPod as a backup device? How do I take spreadsheets and databases? How do I rip DVDs? People don't even realize that you can take a DVD and not, instead of having to pay $15 at the iTunes store to buy another copy of The Incredibles, you can just take that disc, rip it into an iPod-friendly format, and then sync it right into iTunes. So it really is designed to be a very, very deep process, so that there'll be stuff that you're going to be using the very first day, there'll be stuff you'll be using the first month, and then even if you thought you'd forgotten about it, in three, 4 months' time, there'll still be things in there that you can benefit from. So really, it makes a great companion piece. You can't buy your friend an iPod. You let their parents buy them a $250 iPod, but you know, if you want to get a good companion book, buy them a $15 or $20 copy of this book, and it will really enhance what they do.
Thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you wearing your hat, I hope, at Macworld.
I'm not going to do my hair every single day. I'm wearing that hat every single day.
Great talking with you. Thanks a ton, and we hope your book is a huge seller.
I hope so too, John. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
Hello, this is Robert Hazelrig from the Jersey Shore. I've got two things I'd like to talk to you about today. The first one up is called Picture It Postage, and you can find it at pictureitpostage.com. Picture It Postage is a handy little software tool that works with your iPhoto library and creates custom stamps that you can use for snail mail, you know, the traditional old type of postage. Yes, you buy 39-cent stamps with your custom photos on it. This tool I liked a lot. It worked very easily. Basically, all you need to do is install the software and fire it up. It automatically looks through your iPhoto library, and then you just shuffle through your stuff, pick an image, and it automatically pops it into a little stamp for you. The way you order it is there's a little button at the bottom that says Buy Postage. You click a button, and it sends the image off to the picture at postage people, who then mail back the stamps to you that you can use for, oh, things like wedding invitations and Christmas cards or holiday cards. I'm sure you get the idea. I was thinking of using it for my business by sticking my logo in there. So the price is reasonable. How reasonable? How is freeware? I love freeware. Well, this is freeware. You can go download it for free. You can try it out. And you only have to give anybody any money if you buy the stamps. So go check it out. It's fun and easy to do. And again, that was PictureItPostage.com. The next thing I want to talk to you about is a game. Quite honestly, I don't review a lot of games because I don't have a lot of time to play games. I work full-time, I freelance, and I do this podcasting thing, so that eats up most of my time. So what I look for in a game is something that's quick and easy to learn, so you don't have a lot of story or plot lines to get involved with. I do like role-playing games. I do like first-person shooters, but, you know, to get involved in those, like World of Warcraft things, you know, I don't have 80 hours to kill. Sorry, folks. So the game I'm reviewing today is Wingnuts 2, and I've got a secret for you. If you go to freeverse.com right now, click on the Wingnuts 2 page, you will see there is a free download. That's right, free download of Wingnuts 1. Now, Wingnuts Fun is a great game. It's a lot of fun to play, but Wingnuts 2 is even better. So, it's not a terribly involved game. You fly an airplane around, you shoot up your enemies, and I find it very entertaining. So hurry now to freeverse.com to get your free download of Wingnuts 1. I do not know how long that will be free, so you might want to check that out as soon as possible. And I have one last thing to tell you about Wingnuts 2. Wingnuts 2 is only $30, and it's a family game. You would be able to give this game to just about anybody, and they will have hours of fun on it. That's it for me this week. This has been Robert Hazelrig from the Jersey Shore. Thanks for listening.
Good evening. This is Not Mac News. I'm your host, Guy Searle, bringing you all of tomorrow's fake news today. Send any comments to notmacnews@gmail.com. Dateline, Cupertino, California. With Macworld soon to be here, you would think that the news would revolve around, I don't know, new Macintosh computers. But most Apple speculation seems to revolve around a product that Apple hasn't announced or even publicly expressed an interest in. No, the product is not the whatever they decide to eventually call the ITV, but what most pundits have named the iPhone. While the guessing game has remained high, Not Mac News has the actual scoop on what the product is and how it will operate. Apple has always been known for its high style, and the iPhone will be no exception. Much like the iPod, it will feature a rotary dial, but in the case of the iPhone, the dial will have 10 holes that will be used to select each number as required. The device is simplicity itself, as all you need to do is stick your finger in the hole designated for each number and rotate it around to a small sort of crescent moon-shaped stopping device. Lift your finger from the hole and the rotary dial will return to its starting point. The box that will house the rotary dial is approximately 5 inches across and about 10 inches long, the user will speak into an elongated U-shaped device with one side designated for listening and the other side for speaking. The speaking-listening part of the iPhone will be connected to a rotary dial part by a long coiled cord. When the user has finished using the advanced communication device, they simply need to place the speaking listening part of the iPhone into an advanced holder specially built to house the listening part. One of the things that made the iPod popular was the great number of accessories available, and there have been some announced for the iPhone as well. For those times when people try to call and you're not there, Apple has created the iAnswering iMachine that plugs in between your iPhone and your home personal communications network. Apple, always known for not following the crowd, has decided that the first version will only operate at the user's home. Also, production is following the Made in America trend by having AT&T build the device for Apple. Production is already complete for the first version, with some 500 million of the devices sitting in AT&T warehouses around the country. Not Mac News. We are the annoying busy signal in Internet Mac News. I'm Guy Searle, and I wish you a good night.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.